Welcome once again to the Eater of Words. My name is Simon, and if I sound tired or my voice starts cracking, that's because we are recording at 9 p.m. Because my guest today is very busy, and I am just happy that he takes the time out of his busy day to talk to me today. He was my mentor during the MFA in writing program at the University of Saskatchewan. Somehow, he did not quit his mentor duties after that year. He is I guess I can call you a best-selling author of YA novels?
Sure.
I don't know internationally, but I know that your work has been translated into various languages, among them German. And yeah, I'm very happy to call him a friend. Art Slade. Art, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah. You can call me a friend, of course.
Thank you.
I'm glad our friendship survived the mentorship.
Yeah, so this is going to be interesting because a lot of the things that we're going to talk about, in the beginning at least, I've already asked you, so I know, but the millions and millions of potential listeners probably don't know these things. So yeah, let's just get into it. I did research a little bit, and by research I mean I looked at your Wikipedia page that reads suspiciously like your little biographies in your books. So I don't know who wrote it.
I don't know who wrote it either.
But maybe you should update it. because the series that we're going to talk about today, at least one book of the series that we're going to talk about today, the Amber Fang series, is not on there yet. But what I did read and what I think you also told me back in the day was that you started writing in high school. Is that correct?
That is correct. I started writing in grade 11 when I was 16. And a teacher gave me 100% on a short story.
Oh, wow.
Which, yeah, changed my life. It was the first time I was really kind of rewarded for writing. And I thought, wow, if I can get 100% of writing a short story, I can obviously write a novel. That's going to be really easy. And yeah, no one ever wants to read that first novel I wrote. It was just dreadful.
But you wrote it, and it went better from there.
It did, although I always feel depressed when I tell people this, but people who haven't been published yet see it as a sign of hope. In that I had to write six novels before my first book was published. So it took me it was about 10 years of writing before I finally got published. And I think everybody can take hope from that because I know that they're all a lot smarter than me, and they'll get that novel either the first one right or the second one, not the seventh one.
I like that you said it took you 10 years to publish something, because also on your page it says that you published your first short story in university. So now, doing the math, you just said that it took you 10 years to get from high school to university.
Well, I should have been more specific. 10 years to get my first book published.
There we go.
Yes, that's the confusing part. Although it's funny, and if I could go on a little bit of a...
Sure.
Segue. It's how I felt. Like I getting stories published was great, but I didn't feel like I was an author until I had a novel published, because that's what I read all the time. So that's when I really felt, oh yeah, I did it. Finally, I'm really an author, even though I had probably 20 short stories and maybe 30 or 40 different articles published. I just didn't feel like a writer until I had something I could hit people with.
That's interesting, but I know that feeling. And saying that you, like when you said that you had to write six novels to get one published, that makes me dread the next five things that I'm going to write. What I also saw was that you wrote a book of nonfiction that I had no idea that you did. Because I introduced you as a YA author, and that's 98% of what you write, I would say. But you also wrote a John Diefenbaker biography. How did that happen?
And that's actually for young adults too, but it's creative nonfiction is what they called it. And that happened because back then, that's like the year 2000, so that's a while ago. The company actually approached me and said that, you know, they're looking for Canadian authors to write about I think they called it the Quest series. I called it the Dead Canadian series because it was always somebody who was semi-famous and dead. And and so they actually assigned, you know, I said, of course I needed money, so I said, sure, I'll do it. They pay up front. And they assigned John Diefenbaker, who was, of course, everybody knows this, but I'll say, our prime minister from Saskatchewan, but he was the prime minister of Canada from 1957 to 1963. So that's how I got it. I was desperate for money, and also it looks like kind of fun. It looks like something different. Yeah. And I like the idea of creative nonfiction. I did learn by the end of it that nonfiction is a lot of work. Like, you have to, like, look things up, and when people speak, you know, they actually have to have really said those words.
But by doing it, you learn that maybe you don't want to do it again, so.
That's right. The last thing that it stuck me with, and I did enjoy it. I learned a lot, but it stuck me with, it made me into kind of a political junkie, because I had to research all the different political parties in Canada and all their history. It was just so, it seems boring until you start researching it. I found it really interesting. And now all I do, whenever there's an election, which is coming up here, I go and, you know, get the popcorn out and watch and really have fun with it.
It is a bit of a freak show to politics, so it's, I can get the popcorn part. Especially these days. Did they pick you because you were from Saskatchewan, or was it a nationwide thing?
Yeah, well, they partly picked me because there were two other writers from Saskatchewan who had written for them. One wrote the biography of Pierre Trudeau, which was he's a little bit more popular than Stephen Baker, so I think that book sold a bit more. But they just recommended, those two authors recommended me as someone they might want to approach, because at that point I had three books out, and they were just looking for somebody who would accept a lower fee and do the work.
Just as a quick question, I guess, for a follow-up to that, was that before or after Dust?
That was actually, I want to say it was in between. I had written Dust, but it didn't come out yet. And so this Diefenbaker book actually came out in the spring of that year, and Dust came out in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember them, the people who XYZ Publishing they were called, I remember them being very excited that I'd won the Governor General's Award.
I wonder why.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because otherwise I would have had to, by the way, this is why I'm asking. But yeah, no, yeah, you did win the Governor General's Award for Dust, so it's, my initial thought was that maybe they approached you after the fact, but the way that it's the other way around makes it even funnier in a way.
Yeah, it is.
It explains a lot.
I remember the editor saying to me that a lot of people asked her afterwards, said, well, how did you get him? You know, he just won the Governor General's Award. Oh, yeah, we just talked to him, you know.
Knowing a little bit about your background, I also know a little bit about how you write, and that is also very interesting, because you work out while you write, right?
That's right. I look a lot like Schwarzenegger without the muscles.
Unfortunately, this is not a video podcast, so
yeah.
All the flexing that you're just doing at this moment will never see the light of day.
Well, now I could just tell people, oh, they might look up a picture, though, and I could just tell them I do look like Schwarzenegger, in that we're human beings. But yeah, I do work out because, you know, I guess about, actually almost exactly 10 years ago, middle age hit me, and middle age is really horrible. I highly don't recommend it. But I thought that I had been doing some reading about how bad sitting was for you and how you should be walking, and then I read this article about somebody who had a treadmill desk, and I thought, I really should try that. That just sounds crazy. And that's what I did, is I did, it's a very Canadian story. I went to Canadian Tire, bought a treadmill desk, and built a little desk around it myself. And I've walked, I mean, like I said, 10 years ago, I now have a newer, I actually eventually bought myself an expensive treadmill desk. But I think the last time I calculated, which is now over a year ago, I've walked the same distance from New York to Australia, basically, if you could walk across the water, which I can't do. But if I could, that's about how far I've walked in that time period.
I hope you used Canadian Tire money when you bought the first one.
I don't remember.
At least some.
I either did or I got some.
So I mentioned that you write a lot of YA, or that's your forte. And what I've noted now, I've read two of the Hunchback Assignments, and now a book from the Ember Fang series. What I've noted is that you have kind of a knack for taking characters or modeling characters or leaning characters from older books, like The Hunchback of Notre Dame, or I don't know where Amber Fang would place in that category, but you give them a modern spin and make them somewhat accessible to younger readers of today's generation. Do you read one of those books, and like the Hunchback of Notre Dame, for example, and then you get the idea, hey, this would be a cool character if I twisted it and shaped it and molded it into this new character in today's world? Or how's that process going? Is that a conscious decision, or is that just, hey, actually, that's a kind of a cool character, let's give it a new spin?
It's funny, with the Hunchback in particular, it kind of happened. It happened in an odd way, in that I had written a book called Monsterology, which had all these monsters in it, and one of them was the Hunchback of Notre Dame, and I just love that story. That's just, I love the whole idea of this, unattractive, very strong, very powerful hero who's kind of stuck, unfortunately, on the top of this church. And I thought, he's just such a tragic, and yet he's a very endearing character in a way. And I thought, well, I really want to write something about that. I want to, kind of do something, but what do you do? Like, he's in this church. You just leave him there. What story am I going to tell that hasn't already been told? And I happened to be, at about the same time, I got kind of pitched by a publisher, and it didn't work out, and I'm glad it didn't. Got pitched with the idea of doing a young Sherlock Holmes series. And I'm so glad I didn't, because a good friend of mine, Shane Beacock, did a young Sherlock Holmes series that came out like about 2 months after that, so I would have looked really dumb. But that really got my strange brain leaps around. I started thinking, well, what if the Hunchback? What if he became a detective like Sherlock Holmes? And he could go and solve these crimes, and he wouldn't be stuck in that church all the time listening to the bells ring. And, it's just that I like that. It's something kind of silly, but it also, I like kind of that, it's a little bit playful. But I also realized that I couldn't really do detective novels, that I'm not smart enough to figure out who did it. When I'm reading them, I'm not. And again, when I'm trading them, even harder. So that's why I kind of switched towards making him into a spy. And then the obvious problem was, well, he's a hunchback. Everybody's going to recognize him. So they're just going to run away, right? And so that's why I came up with the kind of fantastical element of him being able to change your shape and look like other people. And that's kind of a long-winded way of explaining how it all came together. It wasn't like it just suddenly I thought, hey, I'm going to take the hunchback and he's going to become this spy. It's going to be part of the British Empire. It wasn't like that. It was just that, I could do this. The reason it ended up being Victorian era, because I could have done it in, 2050, was because I was reading Sherlock Holmes at the time. And then it just seemed like this nice little way of melding things together.
And speaking of spy novels, that's a similarity from The Hunchback Assignments to, I guess, Amber Fang, to switch gears here. So I read the third book. Revenge is the third book, right?
Yeah, I think so.
So I'm probably missing a little bit of the backstory, and maybe you can fill us in. I mean, a lot of it becomes clear as you read the first couple of chapters, but maybe you can give us a little introduction into what we're about to enter.
Yeah, well, Amber Fang, for me, was I really wanted to do. As someone who writes for young adults, we're often seen as genre writers just because we write for young adults or younger readers. And then we're also, more so than adult writers, we're allowed to kind of write whatever we want. And in that, by that I mean, adult writers tend to be pigeonholed in one place. And it's like, I've written, history novels, and I've written dark fantasy, and now pure epic fantasy. Kind of anything I want to write, I can. And so with Amber Fang, I really was in some ways setting a test for myself. I wanted to write something that was really set very specifically in a genre, and that's when I thought, well, I'm going to write about vampires, because their popularity goes up and down, but they're always fairly popular. You know, sometimes they shoot up into the skies,
yeah,
and come back down, but they never disappear. You cannot kill those vampires.
That's kind of the idea.
That's right. Yeah, put a stake through them, and they keep on going. But that was kind of the idea in the background. And then, because my brain just works in strange ways, I thought, well, I can't just write another Dracula or another kind of romance vampire. And I didn't like the rule. I see why they work. You know, the whole rule of you can't go in the sunlight, or you know, or that you have to kill them with a stake. All those kind of rules. I didn't want to follow that path. I want to do something new, and so that's why I kind of made it more something more scientific, where they're a species that have evolved along with us, and they just happened to, part of their evolution was they only survive by drinking our blood, and they can only eat once a month, and that's all that they'll need to survive for that month. If they don't eat, though, within 30 days, they end up going crazy, and so they have to eat. And I think I kind of like that idea. There's like this scientific rule, even though obviously it's not, well, I hope it's not real science. But I thought, well, I don't want to just have her lurking around in dark corners and stuff. Where would a vampire hide so nobody would know that they were a vampire? And I thought, well, she's going to have to become a librarian, because A, that's just kind of funny, because we have this stereotype of, you know, the kind of stolid librarian who's going shh all the time. And the whole idea that there's actually a killer inside the librarian, I really like that. And then I thought, well, if she's going to do that, then she's going to need another job on the side, and that might as well be an assassin. Because my idea behind her, not all vampires agree with this, but her kind of plan does, is that they have to have an ethical feed, that whoever they eat has to be a murderer. And not only that, that murderer has never felt remorse for their murder. And so she's got to feel good about, you know, who it is she's eating. And if you become an assassin, and she eventually gets hired by an organization that is trying to rid the world of bad people, then that's kind of a nice little job for her.
It's definitely a very unique and interesting concept. What plays into it is her family. That becomes clear very early on, even if you start with book number 3. So, mom, dad, and sister. I don't know if there's more to it that I've missed, but those are the ones that...
Yeah, you didn't have to read the first 2 books, so that's good.
And to say the family has issues is probably an understatement. So, in this book, Revenge, she's looking for her mother, and two people that actually try to intercept her because they work for the other side are her father and her sister. What's the dynamic between the four, and how did these two ethical vampires, Mother and Amber, and these two other even coexist in the first place? Like, what's the dynamic?
I think that's, you know, that one of the things about writing the book is I didn't know the answer to that question. I just, and I often start out this way, is I'm writing, I just go, oh, this is a cool idea, I'm just going to write some stuff, and here she is, and the first book starts out with her walking down a street, kind of the typical thing, right, and she's after her kill, and so you get a sense of who she is, and you do learn right away that her mother has vanished, and that she can only have these ethical feeds, and the person she's about to kill is some kind of horrible murderer. So she really doesn't know very much. And that, as the writer, that's good, because I have to learn it through her. And she only knows her mom has disappeared, that she did have a dad, but she never met him, and that there was, you know, some kind of falling out that she doesn't understand her mom will never talk about. And she doesn't even really know if there are other vampires out there other than her father. And so she is, to me, it's not a total surprise, but for her it's a surprise that here she has this whole other family, and they're all horrible murderers. They have no rules about who they kill, and they will kill everyone because they just see human beings as cattle. And to me, that's just kind of, it's kind of the opposite of when you read most vampire novels, where they're not all vampire novels, but most vampires see it as just something to eat. And with her, just this horrible shock. This is where I come from. And kind of in the history of that is that at some point the mother became ethical, and okay. she ran away. And so that's this other family is looking for her. That's probably just because they find it. They are equally horrified that there are vampires who have ethics, and they see them as genetically flawed. So we really should get rid of them.
So it is not only family issues and relationship issues, not only with her family but also with Dermot, which I think hits home for especially young adults, but also this intelligence spy thriller, quote unquote. So you have these topics that are relatable social topics, and then the thriller intelligence aspects of it. How do you combine those two? Because this is it never stopped not mixing, but it seems like something that shouldn't be mixing. You know what I mean?
I think I do know what you mean. And with the book, I think a lot of this is kind of what my plan was when I started it, is I wanted to write something that from the moment you start reading it, it just races. Like there's no, it doesn't slow down.
And it does. It's full on, sorry to interrupt you, but like it starts out with this scene at the beach and it never seems like that there's a hole in the time frame. Like it goes from the scene at the beach to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing. There's not this passage of time in between where you say, well, the next week.
Yeah, so in some ways writing that, it's like, well, how can you have anything deeper in it? And I'm not really trying for anything that much deeper into it, but the whole kind of, I think where I, and this will, you'll realize now that I'm making things up as I go along when I'm writing, because my intention was just to tell a really quick story. That's what I want people. But still, once you have characters, and if the characters are interesting enough to me and to the reader, then you can't help but work those family dynamics in, and you can't help but think about, well, what does, you know, Amber really think about this ethical situation, and would she really work with these people? And so the trick is to get that stuff in there so that it feels even a little just, and I'm not going to say that it's Shakespeare, it certainly isn't, but that it feels a little bit more real and people feel a bit more emotionally attached to the character, and yet it doesn't slow it down. And I think, you know, I wrote these things like fast. And by that, I mean, sometimes when I write, I really look at everything really carefully. And, you know, it's like you're moving a little stone at a time, right? This one, I would just grab the stone and start throwing it or rolling it down a hill and running after it and pushing it. And it still gathered a bit of moss. Which would be all the family relations, that sort of thing. So it really, in some ways, it worked itself in there as I was creating it. And then, of course, when you go in the rewrites, you kind of you make it a little bit, make it pop a little bit more. But not so much. I never wanted it to slow down. That was the most important thing. Was especially if you read the third book. Well, everything's built up to that, right?
Yeah. So
it's insane the things that happen there.
So. You said you wrote it really fast, and I have to say I read it really fast because it took me 2 days to get through this 200-page novel. One part of it is that you have a very easily accessible writing style. It's very lighthearted in its tone, conversational, and it's punny. There's a lot of puns. And
there are, sorry.
Everybody who knows you knows that that can happen.
Yeah.
But you also throw in contemporary literary references or things that pop culture in the last 10, 15 years has unleashed on us. You name drop Twilight. You name drop The Hitchhiker's Guide Through the Galaxy. And, which I very much appreciated, It. By the way, how is that book coming along? Just as a quick backstory, I gotta tell this. I gave you a copy of It as a little thank you for enduring through our mentorship. And you're currently reading it.
I am reading it. Yeah, you know, it was so clever for him to call it because, but it's also hard to talk about. So I am working away at it. It's almost like reading the Bible in terms of length, anyway.
It's a little more coherent than the Bible, I'd like to think.
Yeah, it just tells one story. But it's certainly, I'm so glad. Well, it was a wonderful gift. I mean, nothing like getting a great big book. But also, the other side of that gift was, you know, I grew up reading these books, right? So I remember when this book came out. My friends got it, and I don't know why I hesitated, because I'd read all his other books before that, but for some reason I delayed. And one of my friends read it, and he turned to me, you know, I asked him, what was it like, and he goes, oh, you know, it just has a stupid ending. And that turned me off. I thought, ah, oh, I can't read that whole book that has a stupid ending. And so I never got, that was one of the King books I just didn't read. It's like, no, I'll go read The Stand. It seems shorter. Well, maybe not. But so once you gave me the book, and then that kind of sense of lingering guilt that I hadn't read it yet, it was like me going back to being, you know, 17, 18 again, and going, wow, this is, I have to admit, I don't really like King's, I haven't read all of it, but King's more recent stuff doesn't move me the same way this stuff did. And some of it's just so intangible, but as soon as I started reading it, it's like, oh yeah, this is what he could do. This is the amazing stuff he would make. And, you know, things he writes now are still perfectly good. It's just there was something about that time period and the way he could get the story across that even though I've, you know, it's been that period of time since I was supposed to read it, even though all that time has passed, it's like I'm going back, I'm going, yeah, this perfectly belongs in his canon, which, of course, no one would argue it wouldn't.
But back to Ember Fang. So you throw those literary references in, I suspect partly because she's a librarian and she reads this stuff. How much of it, though, is just you not trying to connect, but maybe to recommend things to read or things that influenced you and bring them in?
Yeah, I think that's part of it, because I'm not going to write about things I didn't like so much. It's kind of a balance. It's what do you think she, as a librarian and as a voracious reader, and I love that whole idea of this vampire who runs around, who always carries a book with her when she's out killing people. to me, that's hilarious.
Well, you need to calm down after a good kill, so what better way to kick up your feet and read?
You need to digest, so, you know, you might as well read a digest. those are the kind of puns you can get.
By the way, I'm going to give you this fun fact for free. Not that I charge you anything for this, but I just recently read that blood is a good substitute for eggs in baking goods.
Oh,
about
wow.
60, I think it said 60 milliliters is about one egg. So there you go. You may want, you could incorporate that into one of her books.
Which kind of blood? Like from who and what? And
that I'd have to research again, but I think...
Yeah. Okay, well, just don't go to prison just to have breakfast. Well, the one thing... But I think with Amber Fang and the idea of her being a librarian and also being aware of the culture around her, because she's not really part of it. She feels, being the only vampire, she feels isolated from it, but she can't help but consume it. And so I like throwing that back out at the reader and saying, this is what she likes, this is what she's reading, this is the funny stuff that she laughs at. And I think that makes her more real and more interesting to them. And yeah, I can't help but things that I'm interested in, like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, those kind of things, I can't help but put them in there because, yeah, more people should read that book.
And it's probably also an age thing because, I mean, she's not 40, 50, but she seems to be a little bit like in her 20s or whatever. So a little bit younger. So that would probably be more her age group's interests rather than, I don't know, the latest John Diefenbaker biography.
That's right. I don't think I made any Diefenbaker references at all in this one.
With these puns and this lighthearted tone, I'm just wondering, do you ever crack yourself up while you're writing? Like,
I think, you know what, I do. And I don't know if that's kind of egotistical of me to admit that, but every once in a while you kind of forget that you've created something. And, you know, in the whole process of writing, when you're writing stuff, at least for me, it's like, oh, this is all so horrible, this isn't funny, this isn't, you know, this violent scene isn't violent enough, you know, all those kind of things are kind of going on in my head when I'm writing it. But if I've taken a bit of a break and I go back to it, and I started, and I do have memories of this with Amber Fang, is going back and going, oh, that's actually kind of funny. Oh, that does work, you know. And if it makes me laugh, then it'll make at least 2% of the population laugh. So that's all I'm really aiming for.
That's all that really matters, I guess.
The top 2%.
One more question about Amber that I have, and that's pretty straightforward, is so far it's 4 books, right?
3 books in Amber Fang, yeah. I'm actually writing a prequel right now. By right now, I mean I started in November and put it down, and now November is coming around again, so maybe I should pick it up again. But yeah, there's just the 3 main books.
Okay. Is there a plan, like, do you say, okay, now you're writing the prequel, and then maybe you'll write a 4th book, and then you let it go, or is it something where you say, I'll just see how long I'm interested in this, and then, you know, maybe the prequel turns into a 2nd prequel, you never know. But is that just something, let's see how long I can have fun with this, or do you say, I've written 3 books, I'll go George Lucas, and then I'll just let it go. Let it go. Like, is there a bigger plan, a bigger picture?
I'll just take my $10 billion like George Lucas did. Yeah, I'd gladly do that.
Let Disney buy you out.
That's right. The prequel itself is really, that was just me. It's kind of, because I do a lot of self-publishing, the prequel was an idea of something I could write that wouldn't be too long, it wasn't going to be a whole novel, that I could give away to people to pull them into the series. And so that was part of the idea, just because I had this. I had been, again, this is my weird sense of humor. At one point, and I forget if it's in the 2nd book, or maybe it's the 1st book, she mentions that she gets in trouble with the mob in Boston. And she ends up booting somebody's head off. And just that whole image is just totally disgusting. But I thought, I have to write about that. I think that is a great scene. That's what the prequel is going to be about. I haven't reached that scene yet. But so that was the whole idea behind the prequel. As far as kind of continuing the series, it ended, you know, it's done at the end of the 3. You could stop there and it doesn't, you know, I mean, there are obviously threads where you could see it could go somewhere else. And for me, it's more, I'm still interested in it. I find her a really interesting character, but I have other series that I'm working on right now. And so it's just finding the time to do that. And the second thing is, in all honesty, is, it just came out with Orca Books. Like, I had self-published it, and then Orca Books snapped it up, or I actually offered it to them. And so it came out in the real world, I put that in quotation marks, through Orca. And so it's just out this year, and I don't know whether it's popular enough and to demand a 4th book. And so that's something, a decision, you know, in the next 4 or 5 months, when if Orca goes, yeah, you should write another one. And then we'll see. Or if I just get an idea, because they don't take very long, is the great thing about them. My Hunchback books would usually take me a year to write. There was all this research, and they're actually a bit longer, even though they're for a younger audience. But this didn't take a lot of research, because I was just writing in a red hot kind of blur. And if I can continue that kind of pattern, then that I will kind of continue on. So that's my vague answer to your question.
That's a perfectly valid, vague answer. Moving on to the 2nd part, I always ask for recommendations from my guests for a book by somebody else, so that they don't only get to talk about themselves, but also about something that they've read by somebody else. So you chose The Absence of Sparrows by Kurt Kirchmeier. It's so much easier to pronounce in German.
He's actually from Saskatoon, so and for me, just last year, he kind of came out of the blue. I didn't realize that there was, I mean, I know there's other authors out there, but I felt like I knew everybody, and here's this guy who has, you know, a deal with Little Brown, which is there's Little Brown Company, which is a really large publisher in the States, and he lives in Saskatoon, and how did all this happen, and is it a good book? And of course, you know, I'm hoping it's not going to be one, because who needs competition? Of course, kidding, but I read it, I was just enthralled. I just thought, this is such a good book, and it reminded me so much of, I'm a big fan of Ray Bradbury, and that kind of, he had this Ray Bradbury, and Kurt does a good job at this too, has that really ability of making it feel like you're right inside kind of a younger reader's mind, and you're also in a small town, and everything's really normal, and then suddenly something insane happens, but the way it's written, you totally believe it. And
yes.
For me, the kind of crazy thing in this book, which is when I describe it, people will go, well, that is crazy. That'll never work in a book. The crazy thing is that there's this storm that comes through the small town in the book, and when the storm passes, there's people, for whatever reason, it's not completely explained, there are several people who are turned to glass. And when I say that, it's like, well, that's, how are you going to make that believable? But it's just in the way he uses language, the way the kids look at it, and what happens when people turn to glass, what happens to their family, and what happens when you break them?
You know? Yeah,
and
exactly.
All these questions, and it, you know, that's a really, that whole image of just the storm, well, what if that storm comes back, right? And with this book, it answers that question, and how does this affect society when more and more people are being turned into glass statues, and where are they going? Are they going to some other dimension? All these questions get asked, and all of it, because Kurt is really interested in birding, he knows so much about birds, that it really comes across and adds this real depth to the story, because he ties it all in to the ads of the sparrows. All these sparrows have disappeared, and these crows or ravens, I forget which one it is, are there instead.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned Bradbury, because that was pretty much one of the first things that registered with me, was this is like a modern or updated version or different version, whatever you want to call it, of Something Wicked This Way Comes, with instead of Jim and Will, the two neighbors with the diametrically opposed last names that I can't think of right now, but instead of those two neighbors and best friends, you have the two brothers who, even in like their character traits, seem kind of similar, with Pete being the more mischievous and Ben more the goody two-shoes. And I'm glad that you basically explained the plot line of the book. There's one thing, though, that I didn't understand why it was in there, and maybe you as a writer can explain this to me. Because there's an entire chapter dedicated to a game of Monopoly, and I have no idea why that was in there in the detail that it was in there.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, that didn't really stick out to me, you know, and I didn't question it. And I think what it did for me was made it feel normal. Like, what do you do when the world's falling apart around you and your parents are trying to go, oh, we got to keep these kids entertained? Well, you play Monopoly, obviously. And so for me, there was something kind of endearing about that, but also, frightening is the wrong word. Just that it made you realize that there was a normal world, and they were trying to bring it back by playing this game that everybody plays in the normal world, but it's not there anymore. And so that's what was going on in my head. So for me it didn't stick out in that way.
No, I totally get the idea of pretending everything's normal by creating a distraction. It was just when I finished the chapter, and I went actually back to the start of the chapter just to see where it started, and it started with the beginning of the game, and I was like, this is odd. Because it just stuck out for me at that point then.
It reminds me of, I think it's in Stephen King's The Body, where they, don't they have an eating contest or something? Like, there's some kind of thing that goes on and on. I think, well, what did that have to do with it? But I'm sure he knows.
Because if the writer doesn't know, then we really have a problem. But there's some other characters, and more importantly, the family is affected by the glass epidemic, or whatever you want to call it. The first victim is the uncle, who, and for some reason it made me laugh, him and the father are on the roof, and this plague hits the uncle, and I just had this image of him sliding down, all of a sudden being glassified, I think that's the word he's using,
yeah, right,
and shattering on the floor, which is a tragic moment. but just this in mid-motion sliding down the roof just for some reason made me laugh, and that if that makes me a terrible person, then that's how it is. But there's some humor in it, and I almost saw him like waving almost, and then just slow motion tipping over.
There is something. I mean, it's incredibly sad.
Yes.
There is something funny about it. You're not supposed to go ha ha ha. That's really funny, but it's still kind of. It's just like almost like British humor is really good at that. A lot of British movies where people will die this horrible, sad death, but there's something funny about it too at the same time. And so that's kind of what I got from that too. And I do remember that's it's a very vivid scene. And it's like horrifying.
Yeah.
Which is the point.
And so there's then speculation that they enter, once they're classified, a different world. And then this visualization that this uncle entered the other world, saw for a second what was happening, and then just like that, he's gone. That's just taking his perspective, I guess, is also what makes this, in some terrible way, hilarious. And then the same fate happens to the father later in the book. And it's a plague that seems to just affect adults, right?
That's right.
But I noted that the mom is not affected. And I was wondering why that was.
Yeah, well, I think
that... you have an explanation that you came up with.
Oh, I think that... I mean, not every adult was affected, right? So somebody had to...
True.
Not that somebody has to survive, but I'm just thinking about this as a writer. And it's like, if you get rid of the mom, then it becomes two kids having to survive on their own without the mom. Even though I know she's kind of... She's certainly been affected mentally by it all. So it's still enough of a blow, the things that happen to them, that they are kind of on their own anyway, trying to solve the problem, which is one of the central themes of any book for middle grade or young adult, is you've got to get rid of, you know, they often say kill the parents. Well, at least you got to put them off to the side a bit so that the kids can actually do something and react to the world instead of being told to go out and cut the lawn.
Yeah. I was wondering, because she also has mental health issues, and I was always trying to connect them with her not being affected, because then the eventual explanation with... What was the essential explanation? It was related to the soul?
Yeah, there's a... And I don't know if I could say exactly, you know, what the explanation was, and, maybe I don't want to give it away.
Well, it wasn't so much an explanation, it was more of a speculation.
Yes, that's right. Because I think that's the great thing about any of this type of literature, of the fantastic like this, is that you can sit and you can almost start arguing about, well, what did it really mean? And even the characters don't know. They just know that they've been through this kind of horrendous, you know, series of events. So it's funny. I didn't think about her connection with the mental illness that she has. Connecting that to her being able to survive this, or being ignored by the storms, or however they select their victims. Or, again, how do they? You know, there isn't an odd. That's what kind of partly was so frightening about it, is there isn't. They just need to choose whoever. It's whoever they're going through the town. And it's bam, bam, bam. And it's going to be the preacher, and then it's going to be this person, and you know, you don't know who's next. There's no reason to it, and that makes it a bit more frightening.
Except that whatever affects this does not choose children for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So just like your book, this plays over the course of a certain time frame that doesn't feel like it's disconnected. What do you think does that do in effect if you have a story that has one continuous time frame?
Mm-hmm.
And
you know, I think...
Is it something that depends on the story itself, or is that, does the effect change?
My kind of idea behind it is that, and the idea, because I couldn't even tell you how much time, you know, passes in the length of the novel, but it does feel like it's all really continuous, right? And I think part of that is, it's not like 6 months pass or anything like that, you know, or
no.
they suddenly go to university or anything like
that. No, I know it's during the summer break of school. Because I think it mentions that at some point.
So, but I think what that, to me, what that is about maintaining belief, you know, there's so many things that whenever you're reading something that's fantastical, whether it's horror or pure fantasy, you want people to believe it. And so that whole idea that this is only happening in a short period of time, I think at some level in our heads, we go, well, that's believable because it didn't last, you know, 10 years, because 10 years, there'd be nothing left of the world. But in that period, it's like, oh, yeah, that feels much more kind of manageable and much more intense. And I think as a reader, you tend to believe the magic or the fantasy because it's all happening so quickly. Not that this isn't a quick book. It unfolds, you know, in kind of almost gentle way, but not in a very, it gets very ungentle after a while.
That's true. What these storms or whatever it is in effect cost as well is a power outage, right? And what I found absolutely brilliant is that one of the brothers, Pete, uses a battery-powered radio, which is so old school that probably some of the younger readers won't even know what we mean by that battery-powered radio. What's that?
That's impossible.
That's impossible. So that was, for me, back to the Bradbury reference, that was for me, this is back in the 60s. Like, this plot could also work in a book from the 50s, 60s. Kirchmeier also has references to modern technology, etc. But where you go with dark web and technology and full out, he's going kind of the opposite way.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, at its heart, too, it's an apocalyptic novel. I mean, this is, even though it seems like a little thing at the beginning, it's just about two brothers and this weird storm. Oh, this is the whole world, in fact. Often with these kind of stories, it's just like one little town, and it's this weird thing that, you know, will be, you know, if it was a Stephen King story, it will be like a little headline in a newspaper somewhere, and nobody ever knows what happened, why that town disappeared.
Yeah.
Whereas this is, everybody's going to be talking about this for years and years to come to try and figure out why this happened.
Yeah, and kind of glad that you mentioned King here, because he always takes the out, or a lot of times takes the out of, it wasn't explained why it's just this town and nobody else takes notice of it. So,
yeah.
And here it's acknowledged it's a worldwide epidemic, but everything is shut off because technology is failing, electricity is failing, everything that connects the world is failing once this storm hits. So then for that moment, you're secluded from the rest, which is kind of a clever way to circumvent that.
That's right. And it makes it more interesting to me because it really, instead of being just a small story, it becomes quite a big story, but you're still but you're still looking at it through the eyes of the smaller characters in the smaller town.
No, I got to say, I really enjoyed it. There's usually two topics where my brain just kind of spaces out. One is the sea. I can't focus on stories that play at sea or like pirate stories or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's just, I always spaced out, and it doesn't matter how well it's written or how gripping the story is, that's just my brain. And the other one's birds. So when I read that title and then read like the text on the back of the book, I was like, oh. But this actually kept my interest, so.
Oh, wow, that's even.
You showed
even,
me.
Even
you showed me.
If you do birds right, they're interesting.
Alrighty, I guess that wraps it up more or less for today. I don't know, do you have a book coming out soon? Anything else that you would like to mention?
Oh, I do. I actually have another series, and the first book in the series. It's my first pure fantasy series, and it's called, I seem to have this theme of having either secret agents or assassins, but this one is called Dragon Assassin, and it's about a young girl who, by young, I mean she's 15, who has been trained to be an assassin. And in this world that she's in, people fly, the assassins use these giant black swans to get to the different castles and kill people, you know, happy little story like that. But she ends up through, it's a long story, which is why it's called a novel, ends up having a dragon. And so she's become this assassin who has a dragon, which makes her incredibly powerful. But also as an emperor who doesn't want her or any of the assassins to be around anymore. So that's actually coming out on, it's the strangest release date ever, on December 26th. So right the day after Christmas, in case, you know, people have nothing to do on Boxing Day, they can go to the bookstore and pick up the book.
Since you said it's an odd release date, I just wanted to say, you know, Christmas would actually be probably better if you had it before Christmas, like December 15th or 16th. But yeah. Christmas is next year as well, so.
That's right. Yeah, I've been meaning to ask them why that date.
Then again, you'll stand out more. Not that
that's
it's
right. Oh,
not,
yeah.
Not that you're not outstanding enough, but.
Oh, thank you. But publishers do that sometimes. They do release things in January, especially if they want someone to get on the New York Times bestseller list. You release it in January so that you have not as much competition, and there's a better chance that it'll end up on the top of that list. So
uh-huh.
I'm sure that's what they're thinking. Or maybe this was the only day they had free to put a book out. So there you go.
Well, thank you for
You're welcome.
Taking the time to talk to me. It was, as always, a pleasure. I guess that wraps it up for today. Thank you to all who will actually listen to this. And stay literate.